across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast. My name is definitely Howard Hughes, and this is Still the Unexplained. Hey, thank you for being with me as we get to the end of August here, staring down the barrel of September. I hope that life is treating you well. Thank you very much for all of your emails. Please keep them coming. You know that if you want to communicate with me, the best way to do it is by old-fashioned email. Go to my website, designed and created by Adam. It is theunexplained.tv. Follow the link and you can send me an email from there. Always pleased to see your emails. And if your email requires a response, then let me know and it will get one. If not, please know that I see every email that comes in and I'm very appreciative for them. And when you get in touch, please tell me, number one, who you are, number two, where you are, and number three, how you use this show. Now, on this edition of The Unexplained, I want to include a couple of items for posterity that were on my very recent radio shows, just to preserve them here online so that you can hear them. The first one is a catch-up with Professor Avi Loeb from Harvard University, who, of course, as you may know, is the driving force behind the Galileo Project, the project that will use science to look behind the stories of UFOs and UAPs and possibly extraterrestrials, and hopefully come up with a conclusion, certainly come up with a lot of new evidence. So Professor Avi Loeb has given us his time. He's on here first, and following him, a catch-up from a recent edition of my radio show with the alien hunter Daryl Sims. I got in touch with Daryl after one of the newspapers here. The Daily Star ran a piece about him and the number of recovered items from people who'd had contact supposedly with ETs, the number of alien implants, to be more specific, that he'd been involved with. And there's some new information here that wasn't included on a recent podcast with him. So Daryl Sims, second on this edition. Not going to waste any time. Thank you very much for being part of my show. Let's get straight to it. And we start with my conversation with Professor Avi Loeb. Avi, thank you so much for giving up part of your Sunday for us. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
2021, we're three quarters of the way through it, very nearly. It's been quite a year for space exploration and space developments, hasn't it?
Yes, it was. And the future may be even brighter.
How so? What do you think is going to illuminate us even more?
Well, I should first start by saying that Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos used their wealth to lift their body by 1% of the radius of the Earth, and they were very proud of that. But that's not really what space is about. Space is much bigger. In fact, the observable universe is 10 to the power 19 times bigger than the radius of the Earth. So there is a lot to explore. And of course, we know of some exciting missions, such as Perseverance, that is checking the surface of Mars for any signs of past life that may have been there. NASA also selected two missions to visit Venus, which is the other planet close to us. So that all sounds exciting, but I do think that if we discover that there is a smarter kid on our block, that would be even more exciting. And to find out, we announced a new project called the Galileo Project a month ago.
Indeed. I wanted to talk with you about that in our next segment, if I could, because I've got a lot of questions about Galileo and your pivotal role in it. Just some general space material, if we could. There's been a lot of space news during this last week. One of the stories that came and went was the reported mapping of many new asteroids. It seems to me that I can never pick up a newspaper these days without reading of some new asteroid. I think there have been one or two huge asteroids whizzing past Earth only this weekend. Apparently, we've mapped many new asteroids. Presumably, it's a good thing that we know about these things out there.
Oh, for sure. I mean, of course, there are many more of them that are small than big. And we know that 66 million years ago, there was one as big as the Manhattan Island, and it crashed on Earth and killed the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs had huge bodies. They were very proud of themselves, but until this rock showed up. And we have much smaller bodies, but we do have the human brain that can help us design telescopes that could alert us to an incoming rock. And actually, in 2004, the U.S. Congress tasked NASA to find all rocks bigger than about 140 meters, the size of a football field, that may collide with Earth. And so far, we just started the process, but the Vera Rubin Observatory that will come online in about 2 years will be able to map 60%, roughly two-thirds of all these objects bigger than 140 meters. So we, after it catalogs the sky, we should feel much safer. And of course, the question is, if one of these rocks will collide with the Earth, what to do? And small ones collide with the Earth all the time. And, you know, depending on the size, if they are smaller than the size of a person, they burn up in the atmosphere and do not reach the ground. But bigger rocks are able to reach the ground, and we every several decades we see one of those you know, impacting land or the ocean. They can cause a tsunami if they hit the ocean.
Sure, I mean, because of their sheer force and size. What about Apophis? We keep reading in the tabloid newspapers about Apophis, which is potentially a threat to Earth, but not anytime soon. NASA, I think, in the last week said it won't be any risk to us for at least 100 years. Talk to me about Apophis.
Yeah, so the problem is we need to know the speed or velocity of this object and its location very precisely in order to figure out what will happen in 100 years. And the reason that people go back and forth between doomsday scenarios and unlikely to hit the Earth is because we don't know the parameters of this object that precisely. So I don't think there is any reason to lose sleep, because most likely it will never impact Earth. And so far there is nothing that is really an imminent threat. I think we have to, if we want to worry, we should worry about our own actions, which sort of, you know, we are shooting ourselves in the foot in a way by not caring about Earth and our immediate environment.
And of course, in space, human actions are affecting space. I read this week the Astronautics Research Group, I think it's called, made the point that SpaceX's Starlink satellites are responsible for more than half, they say, of all near collisions in space. Fact of the matter is that, you know, for the benefit of mankind, we're putting more and more hardware up there, and some of this stuff becomes extinct, stops working, but still is floating around in space. We have a huge space junk problem, don't we?
Yes, we do. And the question is how to clean it up. And there are some good ideas. The problem with Starlink, the communication satellites, is that the plan is to put tens of thousands of them in the first phase within the coming years. And that will pose a major problem for astronomy because, you know, astronomical observatories usually are on mountaintops far away from city lights because light pollution makes it difficult to see the stars and anything beyond the stars of the Milky Way. And so astronomers usually escape from cities. Now what happens with SpaceX and other companies, they want to put these communication satellites high enough so that even at night they reflect sunlight, and we are putting our city lights in the sky. So it will not matter where the telescope is. There will be city lights in the sky, which are basically objects, metallic objects reflecting sunlight. And that's a major concern, especially for a survey like the one that will be conducted by the Vera Rubin Observatory in a couple of years. So the concern is that we will not know when a satellite passes above us because they don't provide the coordinates of all of them, and we will need to remove it. But then there will be streaks of light coming across that may be difficult to remove at a very high level because there will be effects on the surrounding region on the sky when you record it. The suggestion that was made to SpaceX was to perhaps paint them black enough so that they will not impact impact surveys like the LSST from the Vera Rubin Observatory. So I think they painted one ship black, but it's not yet clear whether that will be a full solution, and we have to wait. But it's a serious concern for astronomers.
It certainly sounds it, and it's something that, I mean, I have thought that there were international treaties and international agreements about these things. I know there are, but they're clearly not enough.
No, the other issue is, of course, radio transmission. And, you know, there are some rules about radio transmission because that limits the ability of astronomers to pick up radio signals from the sky. But even those need to be enforced. The National Science Foundation, for example, in the U.S., has a group of people chasing all the companies that violate such rules. And I think, the more technology we put in space, the more we have to worry about looking from the ground at the universe. And at some point, it will be so bad that we will have to put our telescopes in space above those pieces of equipment that we put around the Earth.
Hence the need for something on the moon.
Definitely. The moon is advantageous in many respects, although the challenge, of course, is to bring stuff over there. It's quite expensive, but it has no atmosphere, so there is no blurring of the images of sources of light that you look at. There is no geological activity. So, for example, on Earth, we built the LIGO experiment to detect gravitational waves, and it's limited by seismic noise. If you do something similar to LIGO and put it on the moon, there will not be seismic noise. It will be very low. And so that kind of an observatory for gravitational waves will be far more sensitive than LIGO is on Earth. And it could detect black holes that are bigger in size. And also, the atmosphere on Earth absorbs, for example, ultraviolet radiation and X-rays. So all of our X-ray telescopes were launched into space. But if you have an observatory in the moon, you can put X-ray telescopes there. There will be no atmosphere to block the view. And so there are many reasons to actually build the astronomical observatories on the moon. The challenge is, of course, bringing the materials there and maintaining them.
Indeed. But we've overcome an awful lot. Maybe we can overcome that too, Avi. I want to get to some questions from listeners. First of all, Luke is on the line from Bromley. How are you, Luke?
I'm very well, thank you. And maintaining them is around the question I have, actually.
Great. Well, Avi's listening. What's your question?
Sure. Hi, Avi. Right, so
hi.
I'm actually the CEO of a cleaning company, cleaning offices and so on. And so my question to you is, how do you clean the space station? I mean, we look after obviously offices and showroom apartments, and maybe we also clean the shard, but I wonder how you actually clean the space station, which is quite a unique thing. Do you get a Henry Hoover out? Do you have a cleaning cupboard? What do you do with the black sacks? Where do you put them?
I've never thought about that. I've thought about some of the day-to-day issues that affect people who crew the space station. Never actually thought about day-to-day cleaning. I don't know whether you know about this, Avi, but what do they do to keep the space station, the International Space Station, spick and span?
Well, it's possible they have bags or something where you can just collect the dust and put it somewhere. I'm not sure exactly how they do it. Now, I wouldn't worry too much about anything. You know, the only dirt that may appear is because the humans are moving around and depositing some dirt on it, on the surfaces. There is no air to bring dust. There is some dust associated with, you know, the solar system, but it's not much, actually. Space is mostly empty. So I'm not sure how much cleaning is actually needed, but they might have some swipes that clean it. And I'm not sure about the details. We should ask NASA, the astronauts.
I think I'm going to make a note of doing that one. I presume they filter, you know, the air, the oxygen that they breathe, and they take out skin flakes, which we all shed, and things like that. And I presume that's all that they would have to deal with there, because, as you say, because of where they are.
That's possible, yeah. And there must be some air circulation that has filters.
Luke, thank you for your question. I will try and find out that from NASA. Listener Emma in Cornwall wants to know about the, quote, hollow moon theory. I think what she means by this is when, I think it was 20 years or so ago, they crashed an object into the moon to see what the impact would actually feel and sound like. And they were surprised, the researchers who did this, to discover that the moon rang like a bell.
Yeah, well, any object in astronomy rings sort of like a bell. Even the sun, we see the surface of the sun oscillating, and it's a result of sound waves that propagate in it, and they are generated near the surface. And we use those sound waves actually to map the temperature profile of the sun, which agrees quite well with theoretical calculations. So the same is true for the moon, you know, that has a little bit of vibrations from all kinds of perturbations around it. And it's definitely true for the Earth. All the seismic noise that we have are vibrations of the Earth. Now, there was a speculation that perhaps the vibrations we see on the surface of the moon are not consistent with a full object, but that's by now dismissed, because we have done much better measurements, and it's clear that the moon is a piece of rock that was torn apart from the surface of the Earth. It has very similar composition to the Earth. There are some small differences people are debating, but it's clear that it came as a result of a collision of a big object with the Earth early on in the solar system. And it basically chipped, melted, the collision melted the outer layer of the Earth, and a chip of that went and made the moon. Now, then of course it solidified and it started closer to Earth, and then as time went on, it receded from Earth. And actually, the Earth was spinning much faster to start with. I think the day was about 8 hours instead of 24 hours. And by now, you know, the moon took some of the spin of the Earth. That's why we have 24 hours a day. It was different early on. So there are lots of reasons. I mean, many people think that the moon was important for life on Earth, that it stabilized, for example, the rotation spin of the Earth, and the direction of the spin. And if not for that, we wouldn't have the seasons the way we have and so forth, if the Earth was tumbling and the spin was not stable. And so when people talk about life on other planets, very often they say, well, maybe we need a moon just like the one we have in order to get the complex life the way we have it on Earth. But at any event, the hollow moon theory makes very little sense given what we understand about where the moon came from. It's just it was melted molten rock that solidified, and that's why it looks roughly spherical. Now, it has all these scars on it from as a result of impacts by asteroids, small rocks that impacted it throughout its history. And as I said, there is no geological activity there, nothing gets recycled. So the surface of the moon is preserved. It has all the scars that were imprinted on it throughout its history over a few billion years. So actually, the moon is an excellent museum for everything that fell on it. And we should, once we settle on it, we should search it for all kinds of strange objects. For example, objects that came from outside the solar system. Maybe we will find some equipment that crashed on it that we never sent, that came from some other planet far away. Who knows?
But we're going back to the moon. We'll find that. A quick question from Mark, avid listener to the show. Mark has heard, and this is very relevant at the moment, that the U.S. Keyhole spy satellites, the ones that they have for sometimes military purposes, they can resolve tremendous detail down here on Earth. They can see something the texture of a grapefruit on the surface of the Earth. But you contrast that with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter satellite, which is, you know, around the moon now, and its resolution, the images from that are so low. And Mark wants to know, if we can do that with the military hardware, the keyhole satellites above us here on Earth, why can't we get greater resolution from the LRO, the reconnaissance orbiter over the moon?
Well, it's because the military is better funded than astronomers. It's a very simple reason. So if astronomers had the same budget as the defense budget, we would do much better.
Right.
Actually, just to give you an example in this context, there is this future mission that originally was called W-FIRST and now has a different name, that received mirrors from the military that are not used anymore. And sort of the astronomers were very, very happy at that gift. But from the perspective of the military or the defense, the U.S. defense point of view, that was very old technology. And so the difference is really at the level of funding, at the sophistication of classified technologies that are important for national security and therefore not released to the scientists.
Which makes you wonder, and it's a question that we can leave hanging in the air over the commercial break that we're about to take, Avi. You know, the military has such tremendous money at its disposal, black ops projects which are put into the budget, but we don't know what they are. That begs the question as to what they might know that they may not be telling us. That's a question that we can leave over the break, because next we're going to talk with Avi about the Galileo project. Before we talk about Galileo, though, I want to get Pat from Stepney online. Pat, you're on Talk Radio. Thank you for calling us. Avi's listening. What's your question, Pat?
Yeah, I mean, anyway, good evening to you.
Good evening.
Good evening, Pat.
I mean, the next space station after the International Space Station, if there is to be one, why don't a section, like they make it so a section of it spins? Because, you know, astronauts or scientists complain that they have to do so much exercise a day to keep their bone muscle mass or whatever it is in, like, shape. So if you add part of it that spun, they could go into there and live like normal people, you know, or as near normal as they can on Earth, like, you know, to do certain things like, you know, experiments and stuff, you know, in their laboratories or even to go to the toilet or something, you know. So, or, you know, some things like that that make their lives a bit easier.
So I think, thank you for that, Pat. I think Pat was basically saying, why don't they do more to replicate gravity in at least part of the space station?
Yeah, that's a very good suggestion. And of course, if there will ever be a platform in space where humans will live for a long time, a large number of humans, that would be a possibility. And we used to live 100,000 years ago in the jungles of Africa, and since then we moved to apartments in cities, and it's a very different environment. So I'm pretty sure that in less than 100,000 years from now, it will be easier to move away from cities into space, and there will be some engineering considerations that they will try to make it feel as if we are still in an apartment building in a city, and giving it some gravity sort of as a result of spin. I should say that humans, the human body was not selected by Darwinian evolution to survive a long time in space. If we leave the protective womb of the magnetic field around Earth and the atmosphere, then we will be exposed to cosmic rays in space. And those can damage, within a year, they can damage a substantial fraction of the brain cells in our head, for example. And humans are just not designed to spend very long times in unprotected. And the space station right now is somewhat protected still by the Earth's magnetic field. But if you imagine something going outside, far outside of the Earth's magnetic field, it would be very risky for humans to do it right now for a period longer than a year. I don't think they would survive. And that's something that has to be worked out how to protect them. Having just the shield of an astronaut suit is not sufficient. And the same applies for going to Mars. You know, the people speak lightly about living on the surface of Mars, but actually what you need is to dig a cave so that you will be protected by the rock above from these cosmic rays.
Well, I think we have a lot of engineering to do. We're making great progress in propulsion systems and the way that we build spacecraft. But we also have to work on, as you rightly say, solutions to the problems of human beings living in an environment that they're simply not designed to cope with. Pat, that was a great question. Thank you very much for that. I want to get onto the Galileo project now, Avi. This year, you've been very much in the news, in the newspapers here. You've put your head over the parapet to head up this project to effectively establish or try to whether or not we are alone in this universe and ask questions. And you wrote in Scientific American recently, I found this today, and I'm just going to quote something that you wrote here. The nature of UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, is not a philosophical matter. It's also not a puzzle that politicians should be asked to resolve, for the same reason that plumbers should not be asked to bake cakes. Policymakers or military personnel have insufficient training in science to solve this mystery, and hoping that they will somehow do this is like the frustrating experience of the characters in Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot. In other words, scientists have got to take the lead on this one, I think, is essentially what you're saying, yeah?
Yes, exactly. And that was the reason for establishing the Galileo project. I should use the previous question as a segue into this one, because, you know, since biological creatures are not designed to survive over long periods of time in space, they cannot really board the spacecraft and move between stars. So what we see in science fiction stories doesn't make much sense for creatures to travel between stars. You know, it just takes too much time. The environment is hazardous. What does make sense is to send equipment. And, you know, we have artificial intelligence systems right now that drive cars. And in a decade from now, they will make medical decisions, life-death decisions. And they will outsmart us soon enough. And you can think of them as our kids, so to speak, just like having your kids where you educate them early on. These machines will learn from experience. You can educate, you can give them the guiding principles for how to cope with the world. And then you can send them into space, and they will be able to survive because they are made of electronics, and they will survive. They could survive very long times and go in between stars. And if you think about other civilizations, you know, we know that half of the sun-like stars have a planet roughly the size of the Earth, roughly at the same separation. So, and most of the stars predated us by billions of years. So you can imagine that another civilization with similar technologies to the ones we are developing predated us by a billion years. And if they sent artificial intelligence systems that can reproduce themselves with 3D printers on other planets, there may be such systems everywhere in the Milky Way galaxy by now, because a billion years is enough to travel throughout the Milky Way. And the question is whether we live in such a reality, whether there is a lot of equipment flying near us. And the best way to find out is not to argue about it, but rather look through our telescopes, because we learned from the days of Galileo. I mean, the philosophers back then said, we know that the sun moves around the Earth. There is no point looking through Galileo's telescope. And they were wrong. So we don't want to repeat that mistake. We don't want to have a prejudice. We want to use telescopes to figure out whether there is equipment from another civilization near us. And it comes in two forms that the Galileo project will look for, will search for it. One are objects that enter the solar system from outside, and they do not look like a rock. They do not look like a comet or an asteroid. And there was such an object called Oumuamua, and we want to find more. And this time around, take a close-up photograph and learn more about them to see whether they are artificial in origin or maybe some weird type of rock that we have never seen before. And then the second type of objects are these unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, that appeared in the report from the intelligence agencies to the Congress, the U.S. Congress, on the 25th of June. And the government in the U.S. basically admitted that they don't understand what those 143 objects that appeared in the report are, what their nature is. And I think it's time for scientists to look into that. And the plan of the Galileo project is to use telescopes that are specially designed for doing this job. The current telescopes that astronomers are using cannot really do it. If a bird flies above a current telescope, the astronomers just ignore it. We will focus on that bird to make sure that it's a bird or a drone or an airplane. Anything that is human-made will not be of interest to us. We will look for unusual objects.
Right. Now, this is going to cost. My listener, Jonathan in Worthing, evening, Jonathan, says, are we getting nearer to the funding that Project Galileo requires? I would imagine to do what you're talking about will require a substantial investment.
Yeah, and the remarkable thing is that over the past month, there were several multi-billionaires that came to the porch of my home and asked me questions about my book, Extraterrestrial, that came out about 6 months ago. And some of them committed to support the Galileo project. And within a couple of weeks, I received funding at the level of close to $2 million. Now, what that allows us is to build maybe 10 telescope systems. We calculated that we need more like 100 or more to have a comprehensive study of the sky in many different locations and have a good chance of seeing those UAP that appeared in the report to Congress. So we really need funding at a level that is 10 times bigger. A few days ago, we established a channel through Harvard University for crowdfunding. So that is available if you just Google the Galileo Project, Harvard University, and my name, Avi Loeb, you will find it. So there is a possibility for the general public. If enough people will contribute small amounts of money, we might have what we need. We need just tens of millions of dollars to do a comprehensive study. And we already started getting some equipment and planning to get more equipment such that we can test it in the coming months. And then once we establish a telescope system that we know works as we want it to, then we will make copies of it and distribute it in various locations and start to collect data. And the data will be open to the public. The analysis will be transparent, very different from the report that was delivered to Congress, where most of the data is classified. So in our case, it will be completely transparent. It will be a scientific experiment that we are doing. And also the instruments that we will use will be top quality, the state of the art, and they will be optimized for the purpose. You know, there will not be a camera on a jittery cockpit of a fighter jet that you have no control over. Here we will have full control over the instruments. We'll know exactly what they're doing. We plan to get, of course, telescopes that look at reflected light, but during the day. But we will also have an infrared sensor that can detect an object at night as well, and also a radar system. And all of these would help us pinpoint real objects and identify them. Discriminate between them and atmospheric phenomena like some weather pattern or clouds or some other things.
Avi, if you were to discover, sorry to jump in, but the minutes are ticking down on us as they always do on radio. If the Galileo Project discovers something genuinely anomalous, something that cannot be rationally explained, something that we haven't seen before, will you come straight out and publicize this direct to the public, or will you inform the U.S. government and other governments first?
Oh, no, we will immediately let the public know, because, you know, I don't want to look at classified data anyway, because it would limit my freedom as a scientist. We just want to collect our own data and then make it open. And this will be available to everyone. And, you know, if there is something really unusual going on, everyone will know about it.
Okay. And you talked about
some people of substantial wealth who'd approached you recently, hence the $2 million of donated funds which are helping you along the way with Galileo. These people, I don't know whether you can name any of them, but are they the sorts of people we might assume, the sorts of people who are already involved in space research?
No. I mean, actually, you can see the sources of funding on our website. There is a philanthropic advisory committee, so the members of that committee are the funders as of now. No, I would very much hope that one of those space junkies that have billions of dollars will support us, because for them, $10 million, $20 million, the kind of funds we need to have a comprehensive study, is really pocket money. And the point is, even if you don't believe that UAP are extraterrestrial technologies, we will show it. So just fund us, and we will, of course, report whatever we find. And if you want to justify your standing that you don't believe in extraterrestrial technological equipment being here close to Earth, you know, we will find it out. We will report it as soon as we have the data. And therefore, I think, irrespective of your prejudice, it would be very valuable to fund us.
Did you become frustrated with the way that we've been doing this for all of these decades, since Roswell, really, since Project Blue Book, that we've been, you know, we've been all around the issue? There've been speculation, there've been projects, there've been secrecy, there's been all sorts of things, but we've never really done anything scientifically. It seems to me that you in particular became frustrated with the way things were done. That's why you're doing this now.
Definitely. This I should first mention that it could be a mixed bag. There might be a lot of things that were reported in the past that have mundane explanations. But we just need one object to be of extraterrestrial technological origin for this to be revolutionary. So we're looking for one unusual fish among all the fish that are all the fishes that our hooks will catch. It may well be that a lot of the reports of the past are not substantiated, and they are either weather patterns or human-made or meteor showers or whatever. But we will find out. And I was definitely frustrated by the fact that the scientists were ridiculing this subject, and the public was left to speculate, and the data was not good enough to tell what is the nature of these objects.
The remarkable and incredibly talented Avi Loeb from Harvard University will keep tabs on the Galileo project, and as and when there are new things to tell you about it, we'll get Avi on again, and thank you to him for giving us some of his precious time. Coming next, a recent update with Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, about implants. It's something that we've talked with Daryl himself and with others about many times on this show. But I caught up with him following a piece in one of our newspapers here in the United Kingdom, the Daily Star, recently, just about the diversity of things that he says he's recovered from people who say that they have had alien implants put in them in various places, in their feet or wherever. We came up with some new information, so here is that conversation with Daryl Sims.
I've conducted 27 surgical interventions as far as India to the United States, removing the alleged alien implants. And in these implants, we found objects that showed to be extraterrestrial in origin, according to major universities and other laboratories.
And that list, sorry to jump in, but that list is pretty comprehensive, in particular, anomalous implants and artifacts. What sorts of things does that include? What sorts of shapes of things? Do they look like computer chips? Describe them to me.
Certainly. The objects that we found inside people are not related to human technology whatsoever. The amazing thing about the objects, they're hid within a biological cocoon so that the body will not identify them as a foreign object. We've done tests on this medically to show that the biological cocoon is not something that the body just wrapped around it and isolated it to, because it wanted to, it found it to be a foreign object. That's just not true. What we have found inside the cocoon is a lamellar or needle-like projections about a quarter inch long, three of them in a lady's foot, in the top of her foot, not the bottom. She didn't step on this. And according to Los Alamos, New Mexico Tech, the examination of those metals showed to be from a rare meteorite from the Yaocheng or the Wittmannstein meteorite in outer space. So that kind of makes them extraterrestrial.
How come this stuff is not on the front page of every newspaper?
Well, in my opinion, you're the front page. You're the best source of this to begin with because you're looking into it. Other people just report generic information. You're going after the story.
What do you think? Maybe you know these implants are there to do. Are they there for monitoring? What do you think?
Well, the fact is that they're not there. They're not transponders and they're not tracking devices because they already know where you're at. We do think that the objects themselves, based on the medical information we have from some of the people where we've removed these things, is some of their neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, they had altered levels, and her doctor was real concerned about that. So we think maybe that the monitoring might be even to the modification of behavior of some of the abductees who have these implants. And the implants are, of course, very, very rare.
So it's possible, you think, that some of these things, maybe all of these things, are not necessarily used for surveillance, because if there are aliens, they can probably find you. They can sometimes be used to control people. I mean, if that is so, that's alarming. The people from whom you've removed these things, and you say that you've removed a lot, do they talk about feeling as if they are being controlled?
This is an excellent question by you. Many of the people, everyone, all 27, with the exception of one, were elated and relieved that the objects were removed. They felt like there was a sense of someone wasn't monitoring them at that point. One of the people felt like his ability to be psychic and that sort of thing was diminished because of his implant removal. But that was the only negative one out of 27.
How often do people come to you and try and have this done? You know, how often do you get people getting in touch saying, look, I've got something that I think might be some kind of chip device or something in my foot. Can you help?
Well, the fact is I look at hundreds of x-rays every year. Many people send these x-rays because they saw a UFO or they had an anomalous experience, and they assume that they have an implant. That is simply not the case in 99.9% of the cases. We did have a case, came to me yesterday, and the lady has got two remarkable objects in her leg, very similar to the needle-like projections we found in the first surgery, the one with the meteorite implants. And these objects are more interesting as well for two reasons. One is because she has no idea how they got there. Her doctor doesn't have a clue how they got there. And the most interesting part of it is she went through Three Mile Island, the nuclear plant, of course, when she was a child with her parents, and all of a sudden the alarm started ringing.
Oh boy.
And they pulled everybody aside and they checked everybody with radiation detectors and found that the little girl, which is now a full-grown woman, my abductee, she was the one that was had a high level of radiation. They would not let her enter the building.
Good Lord. Do there tend to be particular kinds of people, particular ages, particular, I don't know, ethnicities or nationalities that are targeted with these things, do you think?
There are a unique 45% of the people that are taken or report these events that we feel comfortable with are Native American Indian, Irish, Celtic, Scottish in origin. 45%. That's an astounding number.
What do you think this is all about?
That's a good question. Whoever the alien is, whoever they are, they're never going to tell us. They're very surreptitious. They're very secretive about that. So the best way we can find things out is simply to look at the evidence of what we're finding with these people. And that gives us a bigger clue about what in the world's going on. And look, I spent 2 years in Central Intelligence Agency in covert operations. The main thing I learned about the intelligence agency and the craft that I learned there was that the alien functions almost identically. They lie and they lie consistently. All intelligence communities do. Good night, that's what you pay us for.
So do you think this is known about? It's just simply not talked about.
It is known about, it is studied, and currently in Congress right now, they're studying several anomalous metals. Two of the metal samples that they're studying are from, one of them is from an abductee, and one of them is a dear friend of mine, which found metals that, and witnessed the metals being expelled from a UFO. And in those two cases, the metals are remarkable. They are extraterrestrial in origin. They are amorphous aluminum, which doesn't happen. It just isn't made that way. And the strontium levels and other radioisotopes are off the charts, so to speak. They're off world. And the last thing that's interesting about that is one of the people whose metal's being reviewed behind closed doors in Congress, a report, by the way, that you and I are not going to be able to see. They said they applied electricity to one of the metal objects, and it levitated.
Levitated. That's astonishing.
It is.
This is such a conundrum. This is such a mystery. It sounds like it's beyond the wit of our scientists to work out exactly where and who are involved here. So do we have to wait until the aliens tell us what they're doing? How are we going to take this forward?
In my opinion, the best way for us to take this forward is for people like me, some people refer to me as the alien hunter because of my website, but the bottom line is that I look for medical and scientific evidence of alleged human alien contact, and I don't involve myself in conspiracies and other things like this, just the data. Whatever we can actually compute and can collate, that's what we do.
And you're absolutely sure from the evidence that you've gathered and the experts that you've consulted that these materials are not materials that we have and use here?
The fact is, the materials that we found in some of these implants, the materials are like, for instance, like in one of the, we found 8 little gold spears in a little girl's nose on 2 different occasions. And the gold spears are about the size of pinheads. They're 51% silver and 49% gold. But the problem is when the metals that are here on this planet and the metals that are, let's say, in outer space or Mars or wherever, the isotopic ratios or the signature, that atomic signature, is going to be different. That's how you know that the gold that you examine that turns out to be extraterrestrial is the isotopic ratios are different. They will vary from at least 2 to 4% to higher.
I've heard reports of some of these, if you believe that these things exist, that some of these alien implants, when surgeons try to remove them, delicately, they move to prevent them from being taken out.
We've had that happen in a couple of cases. Most of the cases, that is not true. But in a couple of the cases, there seems to be a knowing of the device or somebody's monitoring it and moving it, keeping it from being extracted.
What are you going to do next about this, Daryl?
Well, the fact is that, and it's a big secret, but I'll tell you that we've already done 2 more surgeries very recently, like in the last 30 days. And we're looking to go back to India again to do a second and third surgery on an implant case that we had there. So that is the big thing. And the second big thing is that we have several anomalous metals identical to the 2 that I just mentioned to you that Congress is looking at. We've got more metals that have come in since then.
Do you think that Congress, government in the U.S., is going to tell us a little more about this at any time fairly soon?
I think there are 2 sets of metals. The metals that you're going to hear about, you'll hear a little about them, not much, but other than they're interesting, they're anomalous, and we're looking into it. There's another set of metal that they're looking at that they're not going to tell you about, and that's the pieces from several other UFO crashes that have happened at Roswell and other locations.
Have you heard anything about those?
I have, and I have some very good contacts, and the fact is that the metals that they're looking at, it's almost like the metals that we have that they're looking at are almost a red herring. It's a type of an ideal where you look over here, look at this metal, look at this. Don't pay any attention to Roswell and stuff we've already had for 70 years.
Daryl, thank you for talking with me, and good luck in this. One quick thing to ask you, and I'm not sure whether you're aware of this. There are reports all over the internet, although I'm not seeing it on the Canadian broadcast media, that Paul Hellyer has died. You know, the former Canadian defense minister,
yes,
who actually went out on a limb and said there's much more to all of these things that we're being told. I'm not sure if you're aware of that news, but your thoughts?
Well, Paul Hellyer was a hero in my viewpoint. I don't totally agree with all of his claims, but he was a good man, and he came forward and he did the right thing. He told everything to the best of his ability, and I admire him for it, as I admire you for looking into this.
The alien hunter Daryl Sims, and before him, Professor Avi Loeb from Harvard University. Thank you very much for being part of The Unexplained. More great guests and items coming soon here on The Unexplained Online. So until next we meet here, please stay safe, please stay calm, and above all, you know, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.